Matter of State versus Andrew Higginbotham. Can we please have appearances of counsel?
Good morning, Your Honor. Michael Zuckerman, Office of Attorney General on behalf of the state.
Good morning, Your Honor. The Chief Prosecutor, Lee B. Reed, the Mercer County Prosecutor's Office, on behalf of the County Prosecutor.
Alexander Shalom, New York City, New Jersey, and the court.
Welcome, counsel. Mr. Zuckerman, please go ahead.
Thank you.
With the court's permission, I'd like to reserve just a few minutes for rebuttal.
That's fine.
Thank you. May it please the court. Subsection C is neither unconstitutionally overbroad nor vague. Defendant focuses on overbreadth, so I'll do the same in my opening. Overbreadth is a drastic remedy to be granted only when a claimant shows a substantial, disproportionate number of unlawful applications. Defendant cannot do so. The legislature did not craft subsection C as a standalone. Instead, it put it after two other subsections. A, which covers images that focus prurient interest on a real child by depicting their partly or completely exposed intimate parts, and B, which covers images that achieve the same effect by depicting contact with those body parts. Two ways, that is, of achieving the same lewd effect. Subsection C follows, covering images that otherwise depict a child for the purpose of someone's sexual stimulation or gratification, unless the depiction has serious literary, artistic, political, or scientific value. Defendant has proposed a very broad construction of that language, so let me restate what we think the better reading is. Normally, of course, that reading will help defendants, just not in the unique context of overbreadth. Fairly construed, subsection C has three objective elements on top of the statute's subjective mens rea, which is knowledge. Those three objective elements are, first, the image has to focus prurient interest on a child, achieving the same lewd effect in reference to intimate body parts as the images targeted by A and B. And that follows from textbook interpretive principles. For example, this court made the same inference in State versus Hoffman when it construed the residual clause of our harassment statute to require the same kind of invasiveness that the statute's preceding prongs required, even though the residual clause didn't say so expressly. So this first element alone disposes of most of defendants' hypotheticals, because no one would say an ordinary picture of a child in a winter coat or a swimsuit achieves the type of lewd effect that subsections A and B are targeting. Second, the image has to objectively reflect, as its purpose, someone's sexual stimulation or gratification. That follows from the fact that the word purpose links to the item, not to the creator or viewer. And it accords with how courts approach near identical inquiries, including the Pennsylvania Supreme Court in Commonwealth versus Davidson and the Rhode Island Supreme Court just last year in State versus Hansen. That's 272A3rd 1040. That disposes of nearly all remaining hypotheticals, especially given that the words sexual stimulation or gratification indicate something much more extreme than simply eliciting sexual thoughts. An ordinary picture of a teenage beachgoer may occasion romantic interest in a classmate, for example, but no one would say that the image appears meant to facilitate sexual gratification. Sure, someone could harbor that private intention, but that proves nothing. The analysis is on the image. Third, subsection C expressly excludes images with redeeming social value. That's not a constitutional prerequisite. The New York law upheld in Ferber lacked such a qualifier. But this final element underscores that the legislature's intent was to capture a narrow band of similarly exploitative images. For instance, when an adult exposes their intimate parts near a child, or where there's only feigned contact with the child's intimate parts, or where there's a hidden camera in a bathroom or locker room, but doesn't quite capture a child's uncovered genitals, for example. It does real harm to children when those kinds of images circulate online. The Ferber line of cases repeatedly affirms that such harm is why society can prohibit such speech. and New Jersey's law, properly construed, targets only images proscribable under Ferber. Three final points. First, New Jersey's not an outlier. We count six states with laws closely comparable to subsection C. The only final judicial opinion we're aware of goes our way. Second, even if there were applications of subsection C that fell outside of Ferber, that remainder would still be proscribable on other First Amendment exceptions. This case is a perfect example because defendant himself concedes that his images were regardless proscribable as obscenity. Last, if the panel below had concerns about these unusual facts, much more modest remedies were available. Instead, it invalidated subsection C entirely, then also struck subsections A and B, which were never in the case at all. That just underscores that the panel approached things the wrong way, jumping to the broadest reading and the broadest remedy when it should have done the opposite. I welcome this court's questions.
So you've argued that Section C is not a standalone and indeed that it incorporates A and B. Let's look at the language of the statute. A, B, and C are separated by the word or, which commonly means they're separate from one another. And then C begins with the language to otherwise depict a child, which commonly means that it's different. This section is different from that which preceded it. Reading the plain language, how can you conclude that A and B are incorporated in the separate, distinct language of C?
Your Honor, I think that the structure you're seeing is actually quite common. And so Hoffman, for example, 149 NJ 564 is an example of this, where there's a prohibition on communications made anonymously or at extremely inconvenient hours, or in offensively coarse language, or any other manner likely to cause annoyance or alarm. Now, they said any other manner, but that's really just a synonym for otherwise. It's another way of achieving the same effect. At least that's how this court, that's the construction this court applied in Hoffman when it said, look, those first three things are about invasions of privacy. So we're assuming when the legislature wrote this residual clause with this any other manner, or it could have said otherwise, clause, what it meant was, things that are annoying or alarming in ways that invade your privacy in the same kind of way.
Section C is pretty specific here. It doesn't just say, it doesn't just give a general statement. It's pretty specific in what the legislature was trying to identify in that provision, again, that is preceded by the word or.
So, Justice Pierluigi, I think it is specific in the sense that I think it does make clear that it's covering a narrow band of exploitative things that are achieving the same kind of very, exploitative and extreme effect that A and B are also targeting. So if you looked at a statute, for example, that said no robbing, don't commit theft by brandishing a weapon, threatening violence, or otherwise instilling fear, a defendant could always say, well, I could instill fear by reading French existentialism and making people dread the meaning of existence, but nobody would think that that's the kind of thing that C was really meant to cover. Everybody knows in context it's importing the types of things that A and B are targeting, and this is the same.
The example you just gave, though, lists a number of words all within one exception. Is that fair? So, for example, take a look at A. In a manner, by means of posing, composition, format, or animated sensual details, that tells us that any of these would satisfy A, but we're dealing with a different structure here. We have three separate subsections separated by the word or. How can you link them all as one?
So, Your Honor, I think it's two things. It's the ordinary interpretive principle that when you see a catch-all provision at the end of a serial list, you read it to take meaning from its fellow travelers.
That goes to the very question. This doesn't appear to be a serial list. This appears to be three different ways to portray a child in a sexually suggestive manner, with detailed prongs for each one.
Your Honor, I think the way we at least read the third one is that it is doing the work of acknowledging that there is no way to parcel out every single possible way. A and B cannot cover the universe of the evil that this statute is targeting. That's going to be true of virtually every statute, right? There's always going to be ways a defendant can say, well, under A, I'm not depicting the completely, the intimate parts are, this normally in cases, obviously, hypotheticals are can be, interesting or fun to get into. In this case, they're not, but I will say that when we look at cases, and these are real cases, right, where the defendant or someone else, they just possess an image where some adult is exposing their intimate parts to a child, where there's a very, very zoomed in focus on something, there's a hidden camera installed in a bedroom or a bathroom or a locker room, those kinds of things, you can imagine, and I think this is what the legislature was getting at, you can imagine someone saying, well, that doesn't quite fall in the language of A and B, and what C is doing is saying, okay, it may not fall into the language of A and B, but it's still obviously proscribable as the kind of evil we're going after, and is still not the kind of thing that you have a First Amendment right to send around the internet.
So if C incorporates for the provisions of A and B implicitly, then how can you be correct in arguing that the appellate division went too far in evaluating the constitutionality of A and B? Because if that's true, they had to do that. And you said A and B are not in the case, but your argument in your brief and here is that A and B are implicitly a part of C and limit C.
So I don't think so, Justice Patterson. I mean, it is true. We do think A and B are important sources of textual evidence to understand what work C is doing. That's true in many cases where a provision that is nearby another subsection of a statute will be probative textual evidence to understand what the statute that's actually being applied in the case means. But here, defendant was only charged under C. He wasn't charged under A and B. So, right. Of course, there could be a severability question.
Right. But your argument is that we should be less alarmed by C in terms of the overbreadth and vagueness challenge because A and B are implicitly within C or essentially part of C.
Your Honor, I wouldn't. I think I would just tweak the formulation because I wouldn't say that they're in A or that C is in A or B. I would just say that C is the third in a list that starts with A and B, and so you read A and B to understand better what C means. But that doesn't mean that A and B were statutes that were under review in this case or that it wouldn't be an advisory opinion to say that A and B are also unconstitutional when defendant was never charged with violating A and B. That's the distinction that we're trying to draw, that it's not, he has no, I mean, you could call it standing, you can call it anything, but...
But your analogy to Hoffman was talking about how, in essence, you looked at the other, it wasn't really subsections in that case, but the other provisions of that single section in order to determine whether that catch-all language, that residual language, is constitutional. So I thought that was the same argument you were making here. Am I wrong about that?
No, Your Honor, I think you're right about that, that we do think the language of A and B is very important evidence for understanding the statutory sweep of C and understanding that C doesn't sweep as broadly, fairly construed, properly construed, doesn't sweep as broadly as my friends on the other side would say. But you can imagine any number of subsections of a statute that give you, that help you, read the statute under review that aren't then themselves, that there isn't then sort of freestanding, judicial, justiciability as to the constitutionality of those statutes, right? You can even imagine a statute that's been, or language that's been invalidated by another case, but that's still probative to the inquiry of trying to figure out what did the legislature mean when it wrote C. It wrote C as part of this package, so you have to look at the whole package to understand what it meant when it wrote C, but that doesn't mean that defendant has the kind of standing that would allow a court to say, we want to invalidate A and B too, just because we're here and it would be more efficient to do so.
Go ahead, please. Assuming we agreed with you that we have to look at A and B, how does that still help us to get over the plain language of C, which says to otherwise depict a child for the purpose of sexual stimulation? It seems like you're reading it to mean to similarly depict a child, because you're saying that it has to be in the same way and meeting the same characteristics as both A and B. But the legislature could have written it to say to similarly and instead did not and wrote it to mean to say to otherwise, which I've seen in dictionaries meaning, quote, in different circumstances, in other respects, in a different way, in another manner, to the contrary and differently. So how is that at all the same as similarly, which seems like how you want it to be read?
Thank you, Your Honor. So I think there's just a few ways in which I think we read it a little differently, but it's basically the same idea. We're not disputing that otherwise means in a different manner. And the important distinction is between the manner and the effect. We do think C is saying There are, well, let me reverse the order of this. We think that all three subsections are targeting a similarly extreme effect of exploiting a real child through something that involves focus on either their intimate parts or someone else's intimate parts or something that very closely approximates intimate parts, like posing a child with a sex toy. So that's the effect. Now, the otherwise is doing the work of saying that you achieve that effect through other ways or manners, which is the normal thing that legislatures do when they write residual clauses.
Counsel, but if the legislature wanted us to incorporate the idea of intimate parts into subsection C, there are many ways it could have done that. Here, that was left out entirely. There's nothing that reflects back to A and B that would allow us to make that jump.
So Justice Noriega, I think there are two pieces of textual evidence you have to get to that reading, even if you don't believe it is the only reading. Again, we're talking about the facial validity of the statute challenged by a defendant who himself concedes he had no First Amendment right to distribute these images. So when we're talking about the kind of freestanding constitutional validity of subsection C, I think this court's precedents are clear that you try to read it to save it if you can. And the reason we think you can is that, first, it doesn't just show up as a standalone provision. It shows up as a C in a list of three, so it imports meaning from its associates, from the foregoing subsections. And the word otherwise is meaningful because, and this is to Justice Wayner Apter's point too, it does connote or denote that you're using a different manner. But what that presupposes is you're using a different manner of achieving the same effect. So that's why Hoffman works, because you're saying otherwise annoy or alarm, or in any other, I'm sorry, in Hoffman it's any other manner, but I think Justice Wayner Apter's point is that those actually are basically the same thing. You use the words any other manner to suggest that, okay, we're looking at a different way of getting to the same place, the same effect, which is this highly exploitative image that has, that is concentrating prurient interest on a child.
But again, that language also is only in A and B. So if what they wanted to do was to say, to otherwise achieve the same effect in a different way, then why wouldn't they have used any of the language from A and B about what the effect is, even? Because in A and B, it says the effect is, as you just mentioned, to concentrate purient interest on the child. Those words, again, just not found anywhere in C. So where are we supposed to understand from C that they even are getting at the same effect as A and B? It reads in such a way where A and B use almost the exact same words, except for minor differences, talking about whether the body parts are covered or whether there's contact. And then C uses totally different words, such that when you're reading C, it doesn't make you think that it's exactly the same as A and B, but just in a slightly different way.
So, Your Honor, I think two things. I'll say something about the text. We think that even if you could read it that way to say that C is really going off on a tangent and doing its own thing, I think on an overbreadth invalidation posture, you'd read it as you'd read it in the narrowing way, or you'd apply that construction to it. This court certainly can save it. It has that available to it. And I think this court's cases point in the direction that that's what courts are supposed to do. I think that what's particularly, again, this puts something on the word otherwise, but that is what the legislature, I think, was trying to suggest. And if you go to the legislative history, that does show up in the testimony. I mean, testimony of one witness I know is not, probative or can't carry the day in a statutory interpretation matter. I think it is probative. It's not dispositive.
So take a step back. I want to understand the breadth of your argument here. C is one way of portraying a child in a sexually suggestive manner, and C has multiple different elements that are contained within its description. If we were to agree, and I know it's not your position, that C was unconstitutional as drafted, would you be telling us, don't worry about that, because we can take parts of A and B and put it into C and solve it? Would that be the argument that you would be advancing?
Not exactly, Your Honor, but it would be something more akin to what you did in Mortimer or Burkert or Hoffman, when you said we're going to construe C through the adjustive generis principle or nascitur associus, whatever you want to call the statutory interpretive principle, we're going to construe it to use otherwise the way we're positing otherwise functions, which is different manner, same effect, and that therefore construed that way, the statute does operate in a constitutional manner. So if you think that that it's not what they did when they wrote otherwise, I think you still can apply that reading. So that's just the difference of what I would say our request would be in that fallback scenario.
You said earlier that only C is charged in this indictment. What's charged in count 8?
Your Honor, I don't have the indictment up in front of me.
Let me help you. It references within count 8 the depiction, less than 1,000 items, depicting the sexual exploitation or abuse of a child. But it doesn't tell us whether that takes us to A, B, or C. Can you?
Your Honor, that would, to the extent that's, sorry, depicting the sexual exploitation or abuse of a child is just the general catch-all. So I apologize, Your Honor, because I don't have it in front of me. I can't.
So it's not that, as I understand it, that language takes us to either depicting a child engaged in a prohibited sexual act or a stimulation or portrayal of a child. So it's going to take us back to A, B, or C. The defendant's entitled to know the theory the state is proceeding under. Have you given the bill of particulars, and can you tell us, is it A, B, or C?
Your Honor, so we weren't the state below, so I don't know, and I will just correct one point or just add one point. If what Your Honor's saying, I'm thinking in the moment that it is possible that it then even refers back not to what we're calling A, B, or C, but to the prior A and B. The statute's codification is a little confusing, but there's a different A and B, too. A is the original preceding version of child pornography. B is portrays a child in a sexually suggestive manner, which is the 2018 amendment that we're here about, which includes its own A, B, and C.
So it's not, I don't think from the plain reading of the count that A refers to, that it refers back to A, depicting a child engaged in prohibited sexual act, because the language of count 8 says, with sexually explicit commentary superimposed over BR's image. The specific language there takes us to portrayal. Can you tell us which of the three this count charges?
As I stand before you, not having it in front of me, I can't. I think I would have to check. I do think that it was undisputed as this case has come up. It has been, everyone has agreed, and the defendant has conceded repeatedly that he's only being charged under C. So I think his understanding is the same as ours. So I've been relying on that. The way the case has been litigated is a case about the language in C. His argument below was that if you read C to cover text, then it would make C unconstitutional. And then, of course, the appellate division went further and just said, we're going to strike down C entirely, not that we're going to read it not to cover text, which would dispose of his case, but, you know, would be a much narrower remedy. So as the case has come up, it's been litigated as if this is all about C and the language in C. I'm certainly happy to look into whether there's some issue there in whether he has notice of what was charged under count 8, Your Honor. I don't, as I stand before you, know of any confusion about that, because I think we've always seen it, and I've heard them always say that they also think this is all about C, or that his liability was under C.
Put that to one side. Does the statute, as you understand it, extend to photos of attractive children who are fully clothed?
No. I think that this is the meaning of the language that we think this is what the legislature wrote, or it is the savings or narrowing construction that this court could put on it. But if you require subsection C to achieve the same effect as A and B and reflect an objective purpose, which is again, that I mean, reflect objective purpose is in the statute. So I also want to say, even if you don't agree with me on reading in A and B, importing A and B, objective purpose of sexual stimulation or gratification still tells you something pretty important, because the words stimulation and gratification are not just seeing a person and thinking they're attractive. I mean, you can turn on TV and see a picture of someone and say, oh, that person seems attractive, but no one would say that the commercial you're looking at or the show you're looking at was created for the objective purpose of you know, facilitating someone's arousal, someone's sexual stimulation or gratification. So I think for both of those reasons, just sort of ordinary innocuous pictures of a person who is attractive just aren't in this statute as properly construed, or in the alternative as, you know, on a narrowing or savings construction.
And what about the photos of the child at the beach, at a dance recital, at a sporting event dressed in particular attire?
Same answer, Your Honor, not covered, because no one would look at that and say, if you're looking at the four corners of the image, first of all, no one would say that achieves the effect of concentrating prurient interest on a child in a way comparable to focusing on their intimate parts or contact with their intimate parts. And second, it doesn't objectively reflect the purpose of facilitating another person's sexual stimulation or gratification. So of course, someone idiosyncratically could harbor that private view, but we're talking about objective purpose. So images that you look at and they just appear innocuous are innocuous and are not covered by this statute.
Does your argument that we're focusing on objective purpose comport with the language of subsection C, which doesn't use the word objective, and specifically says to otherwise depict a child for the purpose of sexual stimulation or gratification of any person who may view the depiction? So it doesn't say of an objective person, of most people, of the community standard worth of people, if you're talking about obscenity. It says of any person. It seems like there are many, many photos similar to the ones that the Chief Justice was just asking about that could be for the purpose of sexual stimulation or gratification of any person, of one person who may view them.
So, Your Honor, let me answer that. I'll start with the end of the question about the any person. I think the reason this part is common language. You see this in many different statutes in very similar forms. I think what legislatures are doing when they write any person, and it is important because these are images that are not sexually stimulating or gratifying to most people. So you need to write a statute that makes clear that the fact that the average person would look at this and be disgusted by it is not the reason that the defendant escapes liability, because it has to reflect the purpose of sexual stimulation or gratification for a person, even if that person is actually a very rare person in the population.
What if no reasonable person would have, viewing the photo, responded to it as depicting or achieving sexual stimulation or gratification? Would that still fall under the statute?
No reasonable person. It could fall under the statute because, and this is important, and in fact, I think this court should be careful about this, because the statute's pre-existing child pornography section A, the big A, not the little A, that refers back to different kinds of sexual conduct. That includes sexual conduct that is nudity for the purpose of, I may mangle the language, but nudity if depicted for the purpose of sexual stimulation or gratification of any person who may view such depiction. That's I. That shows up in a lot of instances. So there's a real danger that their argument, if taken that way, actually proves way too much, because there's lots of child nudity in all sorts of images that my colleagues who have to spend their days doing this, see that is not, that would make no reasonable person would find that sexually stimulating or gratifying, but it is absolutely illegal, and society has every interest in making it prohibited. And to get back to Justice Wayne Rapter's question about why do we know it's objective, I absolutely acknowledge they didn't write objective purpose, they just wrote purpose. We don't know if it's objective or subjective. Again, overbreath posture, you read it to say that you read it the most defensible way. There are multiple cases that have looked at this kind of language or this kind of inquiry. They cite a few, we cite a few. We actually agree with them that those cases are prohibitive on this. I would commend to the court Commonwealth versus Davidson from the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, against State versus Hansen from the Rhode Island Supreme Court, United States versus Villard, the Third Circuit, United States versus Amaral, the First Circuit, several cases from Colorado, People versus Henley, the most recent one, that's 488 P3rd 195. Courts do come into this kind of inquiry quite a bit. Actually, they have to figure out what does it mean when you say purpose of any person, and they look at that and they say it really has to be objective. You really would create huge problems if the image were toggling in and out of coverage, if you weren't looking at the four corners of the image, but thinking about what's inside the recesses of the possessor's mind. And so I do think that is the more defensible reading. I'm not even sure they disagree with that. And I think, again, if it's a jump ball between a reading that saves the statute or helps narrow and preserve the statute versus one that knocks it all down, I think this court's precedent suggests you go for the one that narrows it and saves it.
Is your argument affected at all by the fact that we're not talking about nude photos? We're talking about photos of fully clothed children.
So I don't think we are necessarily, I'm sorry, if you mean the fact of this particular case or the coverage of the statute as in an abstract way.
Oh.
So this case, those images without the text absolutely fall outside of the statute. If he had just had those pictures of the child, five-year-old, we call Christine, it's not her name, it's just a pseudonym. If he'd had those pictures of Christine and he just sent the pictures around innocuously, he hasn't violated the statute, even if he's thinking, I'm sending them around because I harbor this sexual interest in them. This case is very unusual facts. So I asked around, nobody's heard of a case quite like this, but he's superimposing highly obscene graphic language on the images, creating an inextricable hole, something that can then be passed around the internet. There are a number of reasons that he doesn't have a First Amendment right to do that. He concedes he doesn't have a First Amendment right to do that under the obscenity exception. But I think
you mentioned that several times, but he wasn't actually charged with that, right?
He wasn't charged with obscenity. He was charged with violating subsection C. My point is only that he's trying to knock down the statute on a theory that it is constitutionally overbroad, which means it has to cover things that there is no First Amendment right for the government to prohibit. And all I'm saying is there is absolutely a First Amendment right for the government to prohibit, or the first.
But in some cases, someone makes an overbreath challenge while saying that that statute could constitutionally be applied to them. It's just overbroad in a substantial majority of its cases and then shows how that is true. Here, he's not saying that C could even be constitutionally applied to him, correct?
Well, I think he's conceded he has a, I mean, I'll let his counsel obviously speak for him. But my understanding is he has admitted that he has no First Amendment right to send around these images, and that therefore, if the statute covers him, that's not evidence of overbreadth because it's not overbroad at all. It's within the bounds of the First Amendment. So he does have an argument that the statute doesn't cover his conduct. And so if this court was to go with a sort of lenity construction that says, look, you have to achieve this prurient effect through, only through images, it can't involve text, that's itself a much narrower way to dispose of this case. That was what the dispute below was really all about. The appellate division went, beyond that and struck down the whole statute and the other two adjoining subsections too. But if this court were to say, look, if this court were to accept his statutory argument, which is, look, as we read 24.4b1, it just doesn't cover images where the effect is achieved in part through text, even if that text is obscene, then his case would be legally innocent under the statute. It would not be tantamount to saying, and this court would not need to say, and I'd urge this court not to say, that he then has a First Amendment right to communicate that stuff. Because, of course, communicating that stuff is prescribable as obscenity. It may also implicate torts like invasion of privacy or intentional infliction of emotional distress. There's lots of reasons society has every interest in telling people that it's not okay to send that kind of stuff around, which would be very different from saying that the legislature did not hear put him on fair notice or did not actually write a statute that covers these unique facts of creating this effect through a kind of composite images. I will say some of his images also have the images of his aroused clothed but aroused penis. So I would also say the court would need to distinguish between those two. It's obviously even more extreme when you're superimposing images of your own intimate parts. If the court has no...
One question with respect to A and B. I understand your position that it wasn't implicated before the appellate division ruling in this case. Is there any additional briefing that this court would need in light of what we've had presented?
Your Honor, I think if this court is considering invalidating A or B in addition to C, which we agree is squarely before you, of course, we think you should uphold C too. But I think there would need to be additional briefing because there's really never been, this has never been litigated in the main as a case about A and B. And in fact, defendant has always, I think, correctly conceded that this is about the constitutionality of C. So I think we would want to do some supplemental briefing on A and B at that point.
More than the fine briefing we've already received.
Well, that briefing, I appreciate it, Your Honor, that briefing was very much focused on C because we understand on ordinary principles I understand this court's not bound by Article 3, but the same spirit of the court can't sort of act as a council of revision and just say, well, there's another statute that's nearby and we think this one has constitutional problems too, so while we're here, we'll take care of that one too. I mean, I do think we've been operating under the assumption that that's just not fairly in this case and that there's no judicial authority to strike it down on this posture.
So just wanted to make sure, I thought just now in responding to the Chief Justice's question, you said that it is fairly in the case, but you meant only C and not A and B, correct?
Correct, Justice Wainwright, thank you. Only C is fairly in this case as something that a court would have judicial power to invalidate or uphold.
Thank you, counsel. We'll have you back for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Ms. Beirutti.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. As I stated earlier, I'm here on behalf of the CPANJ to provide a unique and practical perspective on the prosecution of the cases subject to the pending litigation. As I stated earlier, I am an assistant prosecutor at the Mercer County Prosecutor's Office, and there I hold several positions, but one of the primary positions being the chief of the Internet Crimes Against Children Unit, or we call it the ICAC unit, I-C-A-C. And I'm also a member of the New Jersey State Police Task Force for Internet Crimes Against Children. In our county, the ICAC unit is the specific unit in which we prosecute exactly these types of cases. And when I say these types of cases, I'd like to hone the court in on the terminology, because different terminology has been being used by the various parties and just in general. So the cases that we're prosecuting are cases that depict the sexual exploitation and or sexual abuse of children. They are commonly referred to in my practice area as CSAM, C-S-A-M, or CSEM, C-S-E-M. At the outset, I think it's important for this court to recognize that the statute written by the New Jersey legislature has brought New Jersey to the forefront of the battle that we are fighting against child sexual exploitation. The statute as it sits now recognizes that there is no separation between traditional and draconian terminology, such as, quote, child pornography, unquote, or, quote, child erotica, unquote, because those terms in and of themselves by way of definition do not appropriately reflect what is being depicted in these images, which does include what subsection C of the statute articulates. The Department of Justice, other states and other counties, the New Jersey legislature has formulated this statute to reflect truly what these images, again, depict, the CSAM or CSEM. What New Jersey has recognized is that the world is evolving. We have escalated from traditional photography and cinematography to now computer-generated images of children, real children, as well as computer-generated images of artificial intelligence or AI, which is commonly coming out. However, all in all, no matter how these images are being created, it still depicts the same thing. The two primary focuses that I would like to talk about regarding the practice area is the harm that
so
these...
I can clarify. It's not the image here that anybody is arguing violates the statute. The image in unto itself. Nobody's suggesting that is what violates the statute. Are they?
Well,
forget the print. Forget the text. The images themselves I thought I heard it from the state. That's not what is at issue. It's the text superimposed on the photo that makes it exploiting the child, that causes it to exploits the child.
Yes, but I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
But it is the image itself then, because we're trying to understand and articulate whether or not the image falls under subsection C.
Without the text, does this image violate anything under any circumstances with respect to this defendant or any other defendant?
Which image are you speaking of?
Of the young lady in whatever attire she was in.
So without the image of the erect clothed penis next to her, just the textual one. No, I agree with my colleague in that if it's simply a dressed image of a child.
And does the text superimposed on that dressed image of a child make any difference?
Yes, sir.
Okay, is that what triggers the statute?
The text on the
picture?
Yes, in this instance, the text that is superimposed over top of the child in this particular case does certainly rise to the level of a violation of subsection C.
Is that something that you in your experience doing this kind of work at the prosecutor's office or your colleagues in the prosecutor's offices elsewhere are seeing happen a lot? I mean, we've talked about it being a relatively rare occurrence. Certainly, it's nothing I've seen in reviewing cases in our court. The superimposed words on an otherwise arguably innocuous image.
Justice Patterson, we are not seeing that often by any means. However, as I indicated, this world of child exploitation changes on a daily basis. We continue to see, and when I say we, the prosecutors, but really primarily our detectives that are in these units, they are seeing some of the most horrific things. And that does include, journals and things like that. Now, the journals don't have necessarily photos, but what we're seeing when we conduct search warrants of residences, as well as forensic examinations and phones, we are seeing very strange things start to come about because of the way in which technology is changing.
You mentioned technology and artificial intelligence in creating these images. Is that something you're starting to see? And are you arguing that those type of images would fall under subsection C?
So in terms of artificial intelligence, the way that it's being discussed nationwide. I often go to the Internet Crimes Against Children training, so we do work with our colleagues across the United States. We are starting to see those. And when we talk about AI, it's not necessarily images of these made-up children. It's AI images that are taken from a picture or an image of an actual child. And they are computer generating them through AI software and programs, and we are seeing extremely horrific images.
Is that the distinction that Justice Pierre-Louis mentioned, the distinction between a real child and an artificially created child by AI, is that one of the boundaries of prosecution for child erotica under the endangering statute that we're looking at today? If an image was of a child was created by AI, no existing child's photograph is being used in any way, is that if it otherwise meets the standard, something that can be prosecuted under the endangering statute?
So, Justice Patterson, if you actually look in the definition portion of 24-4, the term child is defined as a real child. So currently under our statute, and it is something that has been continuously being discussed amongst the relevant parties that have stake in the prosecution and or the defense of these types of cases, AI, if it was truly not a real child, although trying to figure that out is a whole different story. I could stand up here for hours and talk about that. But no, under the current statute as it sits, it does not cover images that are not of real children.
Wait, where is that in the statute? I'm looking at 2C24-4B1. As used in this subsection, child means any person under 18 years of age. Your reading of that is that person means real person, can't be simulated.
That is currently what the understanding is, Your Honor. I would certainly urge the legislature to make that more clear, again, as technology continues to evolve.
What if the suspect is an artist? The suspect does a hand-drawn rendering of this particular child that looks almost photorealistic, identical, with all the same language put on. Would you suggest that was the identical situation? Still prosecutable under this statute?
I think it's a case-by-case basis, Your Honor. I think it depends on the facts and circumstances that we have. So if, for example, in that instance, we have this offender that does have an, you know, a photograph image that they took, and, you know, it's, that's also in their possession, that we can demonstrate that it is a real child in existence, then I would argue, yes, that certainly it is possible. But what I ask the court to consider is the appellate division has essentially looked down upon the prosecutors and the law enforcement in this state in its decision. Let's
look at the language of the statute and not talk about looking down. Section 4 makes it an offense to photograph or film a child. We're talking about real people that are photographed or filmed, right?
Yes, Mr. Chief Justice.
It would not extend to what we have just been discussing beyond that, correct?
Images of not a real child, correct, sir.
And you're saying that that's because of the definition of child that's in the statute, so we need not worry about that.
Yes, Justice Patterson.
Can we talk a little bit about the U.S. Supreme Court precedent in this area has said that child pornography can be criminalized without offending the First Amendment because it itself is a record of child abuse, which not only is a crime, but is a crime that severely harms children. And I'm taking that from Ferber and Ashcroft. But then it also says that a photo that is, quote, innocent in and of itself, that was simply used for by the defendant for, quote, immoral purposes, can't be criminalized. So how do you map that onto the discussion that we're having about C? How do we see this under that framework?
I really appreciate the question because that's a point that I thought was really important to bring to the court's attention regarding the harm to children. So in all of the articles that I've reviewed, as well as the United States Supreme Court precedent in this subject area, one of the major things that I noticed is that the terminology, as I mentioned earlier, is being used incorrectly. Oftentimes, when the courts thus far and or scholarly articles discuss child erotica, it generally includes items that are more akin to paraphernalia, just like with drugs, more like paraphernalia. So, for example, in some of the Supreme Court precedent, it discusses when they were executing search warrants in some of the houses, they were locating Sears catalogs that had children in them. They also located child sex toys. They also located innocuous photographs of children. And these were in some of the cases where you're dealing with a true pedophile who is aroused by even innocuous photographs. However, here in this statute that the New Jersey legislature has created and formulated, it's not those items. And again, there is no language in the statute as it sits that this is, quote, child erotica. It also doesn't say that it's, quote, child pornography. What the legislature says in the Senate bill legislative history portion is that we are criminalizing items involving child sexual abuse material because of all of the harm that it is causing to our victims. And to further go down in responding to your question, Madam Justice, it's that we are seeing in these instances, our victims are suffering from depression. Our victims are suffering from self-harm, suicidal ideation. And there are even instances that I've heard across the nation that victims that fall subject to child sexual abuse materials are committing suicide. It affects them themselves as well as their families, which this court and the legislature has recognized for even child sexual abuse victims. It doesn't just involve the child, it involves their families. And if this court were to affirm the appellate division decision, it essentially eliminates these individual status or statuses as victims. And if we do that, it is going to effectively eliminate their ability to obtain assistance in their recovery through VCCO as victims of crimes. Many of our victims are economically unable to go ahead and seek out the counseling that they need or the medical attention that they need in order to fix the wounds that have been self-inflicted upon them. Or some of our victims we are seeing act out in an inappropriate behavioral way or act out sexually. So by affirming the appellate division decision, it does eliminate the victim statuses.
So the question before the court, of course, is the constitutionality of C or possibly A and B as well, whether it's overbroad, whether it's vague. Your brief actually talks about A and B and says it suffers from none of those problems. Can you speak to A for just a moment, A and B, which says in its text that it extends to poses that emit sensuality with sufficient impact to concentrate prurient interest on a child. What does that mean in plain terms? And where's the line between permissible and impermissible conduct there?
So, Mr. Chief Justice, again, it's a case-by-case and fact-sensitive in terms of what the prosecutors and detectives are looking at. So one of the examples that we provided, I currently have a case that is being held, waiting to find out the outcome of this, because we conducted a search warrant of a residence for an image from the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, or NCMEC, and it was a nude image of a prepubescent child. The detectives in my office worked that case up. We conducted a search warrant that included the devices of the defendant, and within the devices, we did locate images of children, definitely prepubescent, I would say between the age of 8 and 10 years old, and they are dressed in lingerie or dominatrix style clothing, bent over, you know, lips puckered and staring out into space. So, you know, in that particular example, we would submit that, and I would submit as a prosecutor, that would fall under that.
Does the terminology emits sensuality provide adequate notice for what's inappropriate and what's permissible?
Yes, Your Honor, I do believe so. And, you know, it's funny, in preparation for this, I was discussing, you know, coming before this court to argue with some of my friends who are not in the legal field whatsoever. And I was explaining to them what this said, and they said, wow, that seems like very obvious that you can't have or distribute or create items that show children in a sexually exploitative way. The other issue that we're having and we are seeing in these cases, Your Honor, is if this appellate division decision is affirmed, it is also going to decrease and or eliminate criminal liability for defendants. One of the questions that I received from the Attorney General's office as a member of the ICAC task force was, how many cases do you have that deals with quote unquote child erotica? And my response to them was, are we talking about only cases that are charged under subsection C or cases that just include subsection C? And the response that I received was, it was those for which just were charged solely under subsection C. But what I would like the court to consider is that that is not, those numbers that you received is not indicative of how many cases would be affected in the state of New Jersey. And the liability would certainly change or be eliminated to these criminal defendants.
Are you indicating that the majority of child erotica prosecutions are pursuant to subsections A or B?
So it encompasses, Your Honor, a mix of, again, going back to the traditional terms, which I don't use in my practice, but
instead of using the terms, can you refer to parts of the statute?
Certainly, Your Honor. So it incorporates not only portraying a child in a sexually suggested manner, but also the prohibited sexual act. So our cases, the majority of them include a mixture of both A and B. So we're talking about a mixture of children engage in what's called the prohibited sexual acts and or children engaged or being portrayed for a sexually suggestive manner.
Just talking about terminology again, when you say the prohibited sexual acts, we're talking about posing composition format or animated details, or are you talking about?
No, that's the AMB that comes before, right?
Yes.
You're talking large.
Largely. So large the prohibited sex acts that I'm talking about are defined from subsections A through J. So they include, our cases include a mix of those as well as the portraying a child in a sexually suggestive manner, because oftentimes we find that pedophiles do possess both types of imagery.
This is both more traditional child pornography and child erotic.
Yes, Your Honor. And what happens is if this statute were to be stricken, this portion of the statute rather were to be stricken down, the way that the grading system works, it is dependent upon the number of images. So, for example, for straight possession of child sexual abuse material or child sexual exploitation material, you need possess knowingly and all that between 1 and 999 images. And the penalties in that realm do not call for Megan's Law or mandatory parole supervision for life. It is only...
We have a constitutional issue here, and I understand there's serious ramifications for the case, but for other prosecutions, but we really have a single inquiry here, or really two parts to one inquiry, and that is subsection C constitutional? And perhaps we have A and B as well.
I understand that, Your Honor. I understand, however, that this court is very policy-driven in reviewing a lot of the opinions and decisions that come before it. And I think that public policy does help the court in analyzing and scrutinizing the statutory construction that you have before it. And understanding truly, and the other thing to note is, this amendment has been in effect for effectively 6 years. So the fact that we are here before this court 6 years later should also have some acknowledgement in the court that, is it truly an issue? Are these defendants not being put on fair notice? And my response...
Or it might just be a reflection of what you just stated, that the majority of your cases also include a combination of A and B.
It certainly could, Your Honor. But that doesn't mean that all of our cases always encompass both. There are a number of cases that do only incorporate a portion of, again, the quote-unquote child erotica, meaning A, B, or C under what is portrayed as a portrayal of children in a sexually suggestive manner. But yet, we still haven't come before this court because there is adequate notice provided to defendants.
Counsel, I think we have your position. Is there anything you'd like to add?
No, Your Honor. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Ms. Gifford.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. I'd like to start by reiterating that defendant here is not arguing that the words he added over the innocent images are protected speech, nor is he arguing that the legislature can't expand New Jersey's child pornography definition by using constitutionally approved language. The problem here is that the Child Erotica Amendment, as written, covers too much protected speech. I'd like to briefly address the state's argument that the prurient requirement from A and B should be read into C before really turning to what subsection C covers and why it's substantially overbroad. Unless this court has any questions, I'll rely on my brief for the vagueness of subsection C, but I would like to touch upon subsections A and B before ending. So starting with the reading prurient into subsection C. The three subsections are clearly separated by the word or, showing that these are three different definitions of how to portray a child in a sexually suggestive manner. Moreover, as was pointed out, the definition of otherwise is in a different way or manner. So this is meant to cover depictions that don't meet the elements of A and B, but still portray a child in a sexually suggestive manner because they otherwise depict the purpose of a child for the purpose of arousing any person. That's really all I'm going to say on that. I'd really like to focus on subsection C and what it does cover.
Before you leave A and B, were the parties on notice before the appellate division that there was about to be a ruling on the constitutionality of A and B?
Oh, so I was going to touch upon A and B later, but I'm happy to speak up. I'm happy to speak about it now. I think the parties were not aware that the appellate division was going to reach subsections A and B, but I think the appellate division rightly recognized that the Child Erotica Amendment should be read as a whole, and that subsections A and B suffer from many of the same problems as subsection C.
Did you argue that A and B are unconstitutional before the trial court or the appellate division?
No, Your Honors, and that's why the focus here is really on subsection C, but I think there are several reasons I think this court should address the constitutionality of A and B. I think it concerns a matter of great public interest, considering there's 50 active prosecutions under the Child Erotica Amendment as a whole. This court has...
No, sorry, that there are 50 prosecutions. That means under A, B, or C, right? Or a combination of them.
We don't know exactly how those break down. I think this court has a full record and full briefing to address A and B if it wishes.
In addition to not arguing that A and B were unconstitutional, you did specifically state in your appellate brief that A and B were, quote, not applicable to this case, right?
Defendant here was indicted under subsection C. So that's why, again, the focus is really on subsection C. In the overbreadth context, standing is particularly broad because of the importance that a law does not reach protected speech of others. And so I think there's a real policy reason for this court to address the Child Erotica Amendments as a whole, and A and B are fully briefed in both sides' briefings.
There's more than standing at issue here, because generally when there's a constitutional challenge to a statute, it's made before the trial court, and the court looks at it at that level, and then the same argument may be made on appeal. Generally, we don't have situations where a provision of a statute is declared unconstitutional when, as appears here, neither party knew that was coming.
Yes, Your Honor, and I think it would have been preferable if the appellate division perhaps had asked for supplemental briefing on A and B, but I think the appellate division did put those two subsections before this court, and they've been fully briefed by both parties in our Supreme Court briefing.
Mr. Zuckerman doesn't think so.
I appreciated what the Chief Justice said about the thoroughness of our briefing on this issue, and I think that I don't think that there's anything to add regarding those two subsections and the type of material they cover. I would like to return to subsection C and what subsection C covers, because that was undoubtedly before trial, appellate court, and this court today. Just looking at the plain language of the statute, to otherwise depict a child for the purpose of sexual stimulation or gratification of any person who may view the depiction, where the depiction does not have serious value. That any person language, by its plain language, has a subjective person standard. Any person could be the person who's taking the photo, who's sharing the photo. There have been numerous courts recently that have interpreted that any purpose language in the nudity context as being a subjective standard. So that's State versus Jordan in Utah, State versus Myers in New Mexico, the federal case United States versus Boehm, B-O-A-M. These courts have held that when in the child pornography context, when a defendant takes a photo of a naked child for the purpose of just his own arousal, that falls under the for the purpose language. And so here we can imagine someone who is attracted to children.
I'm sorry, can you back up on that?
Yes.
The cases that you just cited to us, what was the context of the terminology any person?
Yeah, in State versus Jordan, that Utah law is almost identical. I think it is identical to the New Jersey law, which is nudity if depicted for the purpose of sexual stimulation or gratification of any person. It's the same language as the Child Erotic Amendment, but specifies that it's nudity in particular. And then in State versus Myers, that language is...
That isn't the same language, respectfully. This language is, and I'm not suggesting either this language or that is more precise, but it's It is the gratification of any person, stimulation or gratification of any person who may view the depiction where the depiction does not have serious literary, et cetera.
It's the same language without the literary, artistic, scientific, political value exception. And it's talking about nudity. So it's different from subsection C in many respects, but the takeaway is that for the purpose language, for the purpose of arousing any person, that any person includes the subjective purpose of the person who's taking the picture. So,
what would be the language that would meet, that would not be overbroad, but would address the problem that your colleagues on this side of the room have talked about, which is that you may have an image that for 85 or 99 or 99.5% of the population is not going to be in any way sexually stimulating or gratifying, but for certain persons it may be. What's the language that would capture that without being overbroad?
So the only way that this statute could not be overbroad is if it incorporated the Miller standard for obscenity or the definition of child pornography under Ferber. Those are the two exceptions to the First Amendment that the U.S. Supreme Court has clearly laid out for how to criminalize sexualized depictions of children without capturing too much protected speech, that the statute becomes unconstitutionally overbroad. The problem here is that neither of those standards can be read into this statute because it's not what the legislature intended. The legislature here explicitly intended to go beyond child pornography, to extend the definition beyond prohibited sexual acts, narrowly defined prohibited sexual acts, which is how Ferber defines child pornography, to include generally a child erotica. The actual word child erotica is used in the legislative statement accompanying the bill, and it's meant to cover nearly naked, suggestively posed, inappropriately sexualized children. Now, if we look at subsection C, this doesn't even require that the child be nude or partially clothed in any way. This would, plain language, would apply to a fully clothed depiction of a child. And so even if there's some sort of objective standard that's read into subsection C, it's still unconstitutionally overbroad because it covers any depiction of teenage sexuality. This covers any child who's under 18, including someone under 18 who takes a photo of themselves. So if we think about some of the types of images that could fall under the plain language of the statute, it could be a fully clothed teenager who's making a kissing face or another sexually suggestive face or pose. It could be teenagers who are dressed up for Halloween or a school dance who are posing suggestively.
In any of the 50 prosecutions that you're aware of, do you have any evidence of any such picture like that that would otherwise be deemed innocuous being targeted at this moment?
I don't have the details about what's happening in those 50 prosecutions, but I do think that if we look at the plain language of the law, and then if there's any ambiguity, the legislative statement accompanying the bill, that this is supposed to sexually suggestive, inappropriately sexualized, I think there could be, for adding on to that, videos of teenagers dancing seductively or a suggestive picture of a teenager that someone takes for themselves and sends, or someone takes for a significant other or posts on social media. This would, undoubtedly meet both the plain language of the law and align with what the types of images that appears were meant to be covered by this child erotic amendment, but they wouldn't be, but they would be protected speech. They wouldn't be child pornography. They wouldn't be obscenity. They wouldn't be intrinsically related to the sexual abuse of a child, which is what's required for child pornography. And it's kind of been the underlying rationale in child pornography decisions dating back to Ferber. And again, this doesn't just apply to teens who are taking these photos of themselves and sharing them. It could apply, for example, to a parent who's following their kid's demand to take an attractive photo of me for my Instagram. It would apply to anyone who downloaded that photo would then be guilty of possessing child pornography. So just looking at the plain language here, it's very clear that we're dealing with a substantially overbroad statute.
Now, we've heard from the prosecution that without the overlay of text in this case, or the photograph of the defendant himself, this would not be, this case would not have been prosecuted. What is your position with respect to the impact, if any, of superimposed text or text that accompanies what otherwise might be an innocuous image?
If a defendant is to take obscene text and put it over a innocent image and distribute that, that would be distribution of obscenity. That's not protected speech. That could be prosecuted under New Jersey's obscenity exception. Just the possession of that image with obscene text written on top, that is protected speech under Stanley versus Georgia. Possession of obscenity is protected. It differs from child pornography. So if someone is attracted to children and expresses that in the confines of their own home, we may not like that, we may not deem that moral or valuable speech, but that's not illegal for that person to express that in the confines of their own home. But
here we have an allegation of distribution.
Distribution, if the text is obscene, then would fall under New Jersey's obscenity statute. And so defendant here is not denying that he could be prosecuted under New Jersey's obscenity statute, but what he can't be indicted under is an unconstitutionally overbroad law, which is what we have here.
I'm sorry. I know that I had asked this to your colleague on the other side, and he said he would let you speak for yourself, but your point there is that you could not be prosecuted under subsection C. Your client, I'm sorry, could not be prosecuted under subsection C no matter what, because the obscenity law is a totally separate statute that would require a totally separate indictment, and it's not this case.
Yes, Your Honor. And I think, you know, this does, you know, jog my memory of something that I wanted to raise as well, which is many of the examples that the state cites to of things that would fall under C, like someone taking a photo of his genitals with a sleeping child in the picture. That would fall under our existing child pornography laws. It would fall under the endangering statute. It would fall under the lewdness statute. That's not the type of conduct that, or the type of content, I should say, that this statute was meant to cover. This was meant to cover sexually suggestive photos of children that don't meet the definition of existing definition of child pornography, which is the definition of child pornography that's been approved by Ferber and has been reiterated in Williams and in Free Speech Coalition as being the standard by which to judge whether something meets the standard of child pornography. If this court has no further questions about subsection C, I'd like to, you know, just briefly touch upon subsections A and B. The language here, as the Chief Justice was pointing out, emits sensuality with sufficient impact to concentrate prurient interest on the child. That doesn't create any sort of ascertainable standard by which one could determine when a photo crosses a line and becomes, you know, sensual enough that it concentrates prurient interest on the child. Unlike child pornography laws that use the language lewd depiction of the narrowly defined intimate parts, here subsections A and B talk about a much more broadly defined set of intimate parts that include the inner thigh and don't require that they be specifically depicted in a lewd manner, but rather that the depiction as a whole emits some sort of, prurient interest on the child. And so some examples that I gave in my brief of depictions that would fall under A and B would be a teenager posing very suggestively in a bathing suit that would reveal the teenager's inner thigh. It could be a friend touching another friend on her clothes behind in a sexual manner that would fall under subsection B. These are just two examples, but they show how this definition extends to the same types of depictions of teenage sexuality that are covered by subsection C and render the statute deeply problematic because it extends far beyond child pornography or obscenity.
Doesn't that illustrate the issue we have here, which is that we're talking hypothetically about images that might fall under A and B when your client was prosecuted, as I understand it, only under C?
Yes, but in the overbreath context, even if the defendant's conduct could be prohibited under a different law or a more narrowly defined law, the standing in the overbreath context allows that defendant to challenge the reach of the statute as it would hypothetically apply to other people. And
I understand, but there was no such challenge here.
To subsections A and B. And again, obviously, it's up to this court to decide whether it wants to reach A and B. And I would just reiterate that I think that because there are many of the same problems as subsection C, we would, without addressing subsections A and B, this court would, I believe, leave a child erotica amendment in place that is still substantially overbroad. And I think that this court has the full, everything that it would need in terms of briefing and the appellate division decision below to reach the constitutionality of subsection A and B, if it so wishes.
Just to get back to your point on C for a moment, doesn't the language, and in this particular case, the communication between the defendant and other parties really go to that purpose of the sexual stimulation or gratification, that the language is meant to highlight that purpose? And isn't that what converts this image? And it's pretty clear in terms of what the statute requires, that here we have the depiction of a child and the purpose by the language converts it into what could have been an innocuous photo into what subsection C is meant to prevent.
The issue is that even if this defendant's conduct could be indicted, prosecuted under subsection C, because there are some statutes that, though they cover some unprotected speech, such as what is I'm conceding is obscenity here, they just reach too far into protected speech. And so even if the defendant here could be, and I mean, and my argument in the appellate division, and you know, I would rely on my appellate division brief here, is that actually this statute wasn't even intended to apply to words placed over innocent images, because the wording of the statute is about depictions as opposed to the obscenity statute, which uses words like narration and description to talk about the things that are prohibited. But even if this type of conduct would fall under the statute, it doesn't change the fact that the plain language also applies far beyond obscenity and child pornography to reach protected speech, and that's the problem in an overbreath analysis.
But the U.S. Supreme Court most recently, I think it was the Hansen decision, where they talked about the overbreath analysis, and they talked about how it's very unusual for someone to say, I can be legally prosecuted, but all of these other people who are not in court cannot, and here's all these hypotheticals. And so they specifically mentioned that in the context of an overbreath analysis, it has to be substantially overbroad, meaning that proportionally, there have to be many more unconstitutional prosecutions compared to constitutional prosecutions, and that the way you look at that is not just by coming up with hypotheticals, but instead looking at the record of prosecutions. So here, are there any prosecutions that you contend have been unconstitutional under subsection C, any of the kinds that you're talking about, or is it only hypotheticals?
I don't have the details of those 50 prosecutions that were, I mean, we know there are only about 50 prosecutions under the Child Erotica Amendment currently. So I don't have the details of what those actual.
There's 50 pending, right?
There are 50 pending prosecutions. They're all on pause now while this court.
Yeah, but there could have been one from, you know, 4 years ago, right?
Correct. And
2 years ago, last year, they've only been on pause for not that long, correct?
And I mean, I haven't dealt with any of these cases personally, so I don't know what the specific factual underpinnings are. But I would point, Your Honor, also to, you know, to State versus Stevens, which is a somewhat recent overbreath case. And there, the court was looking at a statute that was intended to prohibit depictions of animal cruelty, and the defendant in that case was charged with was indicted for dog fighting. But the issue there was that the statute, the way it was written, was so broad that it would cover not just cruel depictions of animals, but any depiction in which an animal was killed. So the court there really did go on to discuss hypothetical situations that would fall under the statute, such as hunting videos, and use common sense to conclude that, you know, the market for hunting videos is going to be far greater than the market for depictions of animal cruelty. And so there, without addressing whether animal cruelty or dog fighting could be prohibited under a more narrowly defined statute, the court really looked at hypothetical examples such as hunting videos that made the statute unconstitutionally overbroad. I think that's the kind of analysis I'm asking the court to do here. It's just that the statute as written reaches sexually suggestive depictions of those under 18, and there's a much bigger market for these sexually suggestive but protected depictions than there is for the type of explicit depictions that meet the definition of child pornography. If your honors don't have any further questions, I'd just like to sum up by reiterating again that the U.S. Supreme Court has set out two clear exceptions to the First Amendment that are relevant to this case, and that is obscenity and child pornography. As written, the Child Erotica Amendment extends far beyond those exceptions and covers a substantial amount of protected speech. Defendant therefore respectfully requests that this court affirm the decision below, declaring the Child Erotica Amendments unconstitutional and dismissing the indictment against him.
Thank you, Ms. Gifford. Mr. Shalom.
May it please the court. I was pleased to hear the court starting with a real grammarian's eye to the statute, because there's a tone in at least the county prosecutor's brief that suggests that courts that find overbreath or find vagueness are somehow endorsing the behavior of Mr. Higginbotham. But as all amici, all parties, and the appellate division acknowledged, what he did is deplorable. What he did is both worthy of our moral opprobrium and prosecutable. The question is not whether what he did was vile. The question is the statute as written constitutional? And it's not. And we have two different attempts from the prosecutors and the attorney general to save it. The prosecutors essentially say, look at these far-flung examples. We would never do that. Trust us, we won't engage in those prosecutions. But Stevens flatly rejected that defense. That was raised in Stevens. Don't worry, we won't prosecute the hunting videos. We'll only prosecute the Animal Crush videos.
But what about the more recent overbreath case that I just mentioned that I think was written by Justice Barrett that says you can't talk about hypotheticals. You have to look about the record of prosecutions.
I think it's fair to say, Justice Wainwright, that the U.S. Supreme Court has narrowed its view of overbreath, which of course doesn't cabin this court to have to adopt that analysis, and I don't think they should. But let's just talk about some things that are wrong with that form of analysis. Is it means that when the statute is passed, you can't bring an overbreath challenge, leaving lots of time where there's lots of innocuous speech that is proscribed. Or what it means is if you have prosecutors behaving well for a period of time, you have to leave an otherwise vague, otherwise overbroad statute on the books until a new prosecutor comes into place. And given the stakes involved here, for anyone who's prosecuted under these statutes or even investigated under these statutes, that is substantially chilling of speech. And I'll get to the way in which the overbreath will chill.
And this is, excuse me, and this is a fairly new statute. Yes. And even as counsel for CPANJ noted, I think in response to one of Justice Patterson's questions, that in her experience as someone who handles most of these cases, has not even seen many cases involving images with writing superimposed. So to your point, it would be the case that if someone were to bring a challenge, even the first time one of these prosecutions happened, that, you know, we wouldn't be able to conduct this overbreath analysis.
That's right. I think that's exactly right.
But you would also always be able to conduct an overbreath as applied. It's just not you wouldn't be able to conduct the overbreath on a facial basis.
That's right. And so the question is, are you chilling a lot of other people's speech? And as I said, I will get to that in a moment. I'd just like to take 1 second to talk about the Attorney General's defense, which is essentially to ask you to read the statute as they want it to be rather than as it is. And so to import into subsection C things like the prurient interest requirement, which would narrow the scope, maybe not sufficient, but would narrow the scope. It's not in the statute, and I think it's quite clearly not there, and the construction proposed by the defendant is the obvious one, and the inquiry stops there. But if the court were to get, say, that the plain text was ambiguous as to whether what otherwise meant, then you get to the legislative history, and I just haven't heard any reckoning with the testimony by the counsel for the Attorney General before the legislature about why what had been subsection A got disaggregated into A and B, which was to make sure we understood that the prurient interest requirement applied both to nudity and to contact, but didn't say anything about C. That's a glaring omission and I think important evidence. But let me take a, and let me just say one other thing, which I think Ms. Gifford alluded to, which is counsel for the Attorney General talked about the things kind of that would slip through the cracks otherwise. Someone posing an adult's intimate parts with a sleeping child, or pictures in a bathroom or a bedroom that didn't actually expose intimate parts. Those things are not just morally reprehensible, but also punishable under existing law, right? So existing law or could be defined in law. So you could have a statute that said, if you have an adult's intimate parts with a child, that is preferable. That defines what it is, rather than this kind of generic anything else, all other things.
I just want to make sure I understand. You're talking only about the small subsection C, right? Because when you referred to A and B before, there's that other A and B. And so I want to just make sure we're all on the same page. We're talking about the A, B, and C, only C. When you're saying...
Yes, okay. I'm talking about small A, small B, and small C. And I'm focusing my argument on small C. But just to clarify, when I'm talking about Mr. Finkel's testimony before the legislature, again, that we're talking about the small letters, yep. But it had just been A and B, and then it became A, B, and C, with A being broken into A and B.
Okay, got it.
Okay. When the county prosecutors were asked to define the line where you go from that which is permissible to that which is proscribable, they responded that it was a case-by-case basis. Their brief cites to, we know obscenity when we see it. But that is, again, just saying, trust prosecutors. And I think it's true. They can give 100 vile examples of mine-run cases that clearly we would all think should fall into that which the legislature forbids. But the problem is, the language of small c also involves things like a 17-year-old taking a clothed but sexually suggestive picture of themselves for another 17-year-old. So that's not only not what we think of as legally proscribable, but nor morally proscribable. But if you read the language, Justice Noriega, that you just referred to, and it's true, in subsection C, it clearly would apply to the obscene language that he superimposed over a picture, but it would, by its plain language, would also apply to a 17-year-old taking an innocent, though maybe sultry, picture of themselves and saying to a friend, I took this picture so you would think I was sexy. That satisfies the statute, and that's the sort of innocent language that we would be proscribing, and we can't just cede to prosecutors and police officers that they'll enforce it in the right way. In our brief, and I won't harp on it, but our brief talks about the history in this country in sexual prosecutions of minority sexualities, the LGBTQ community, being overly prosecuted because of perceptions of that community as overly sexualized. So there is a real risk when you vest that much discretion in prosecutors that it is used in a discriminatory way. Unless the court has any further questions.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
We'll hear from C.J. Griffin next.
Good morning. May it please the court. In the interest of brevity, I will adopt the two prior arguments before me. I think that most of my comments and have been addressed already, and we will rely upon our brief, and I guess, you know, I'm here as an attorney for the Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, but I'm also thinking, and the thing that this case made me think about is being a parent, and I know many of you on the court are parents, and some parents of small children, and when our children are small, we worry about that they might face sexual abuse or that they might be taken advantage of by someone who sexualizes children, and so that is our concern. But as they grow older, our concerns change, and we never stop worrying about them even when they're teenagers. So I now have a young teenager, and it is an experience to see your child grow and to become more independent. And one of the interesting things is that they start becoming taller than you, and they start wanting to look cool for their friends. And then eventually they also want to start being sexually attractive to girls or boys at school. And in this day in social media, TikTok, Snapchat. They also send pictures to each other, and there's all sorts of memes that happen on the social media where they're trying to look attractive to their peers. It's as they become 16, 17-year-olds, almost 18-year-olds, that is a primary focus of their life, dating. And so my concern is I can tell my child, I think the state's response in the brief was that, well, the child pornography previously already would subject a teenager to the child pornography law. And that's true. But as parents, we can tell our child under the old law, we can advise them, don't send nude pictures of yourselves. Don't send pictures of yourselves or share pictures of others that are engaged in the prohibited sexual acts. But when you get to a vague statute that's as vague as the child erotica amendments, all parts of it, it becomes more difficult to advise our children what is sexually suggestive, what is for the purpose of sexual stimulation or gratification for other teenagers and your peers. It becomes more difficult, and that's the problem with a law like this. And then it becomes even more difficult when the state is asking the court to jump through mental gymnastics to try to construe the statute in a way that's just not on the plain language. So how would any parent know, and how would any teenager know what is really prohibited? And I'll finally just conclude by saying, maybe A and B weren't argued by the defendant, but I think, Justice Patterson, your comment early on was directly on point. The state brought A and B before the appellate division because their argument is that Section C is valid only because of language in A and B. And so we would ask the court to address A and B simply because there are pending prosecutions, but speech will be chilled if the court leaves A and B in place. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. I would add one thing to your opening comment that my grandmother said in her 90s, and that is that you never stop worrying about your children.
I'm sure that will be true. Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Zuckerman, rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. I just want to start with the Chief Justice question about count 8. I apologize, I don't have it with me. This is a sealed case. I didn't bring as much as I normally maybe would have. And of course, we're here on an overbreath challenge. I will just say the trial court recognized this was about C. They've recognized this was about C in the appellate division and below. And I'm told that often what happens in these indictments is on counts that are about volume, it doesn't always say which subsection, but it's very clear from context which it is, because you're just saying it's 10,000 or it's 1,000 or it's whatever, and other parts of the indictment make
clear. You're representing that it's about C, as the state's representing.
The state has always understood this case to be about C and only about C. And if to the extent this court does want to reach A and B, I just reiterate, we would like supplemental briefing to address that, including why we think it's not in the case, I suppose, but if it is, why we think that it should be upheld. I want to say a bit about the fact that we're dealing in hypotheticals. I want to go back to what Justice Wiener after said about the most recent Supreme Court guidance on overbreadth. I do think that we're here only on a federal First Amendment challenge, not on a state constitutional challenge. So I actually do disagree with my friend on the other side. I do think that, you know, this court's would be applying first federal law, and that includes Hansen. So the fact that Hansen says you really do need a record of prosecutions or applications that are disproportionately substantial, if you as a defendant who has done something that you concede you can be legally proscribed from doing, are trying to get the statute knocked down sort of for everybody else, and to escape liability yourself basically on someone else's rights.
I thought that Justice Barrett, sorry, and I might be misremembering this, mentioned that in contrast to, you know, unbelievable hypotheticals or wildly impossible hypotheticals or something like that. I don't think it was just that you always have to wait to have many unconstitutional, a record of many unconstitutional prosecutions before bringing a challenge. Have you read the case more recently than I have, such that you remember what they were actually discussing?
I don't know if I've read it more recently. I've also read it recently. It is Justice Barrett. I do take it to say that, I mean, she does say very clearly at the end of the opinion that they've identified no actual, in the parade of horribles, the parade of horribles has never happened, and that if it ever does happen, that's where you get an as-applied challenge. And of course, it might be a really strong one. So I will just note that I take all my friends on the other side's point that
you know, there is, you could stretch to read the statute in a way that it would cover something that we all would agree with is innocuous. That's not the way this court reads statutes. It goes the other way. It narrows them to save them. It doesn't expand them to doom them. And I think it's clear, you know, I can at least confidently speculate that if there was a prosecution of a child just at the beach with her friends, there would be an outcry. We would all know about it. It's not a trust us argument. I just want to be clear. It's really a verify what they're saying. It's I think they're also asking you to trust them that somewhere out there, there's this bevy of really horrible prosecutions that everyone would be shocked to hear and that no one thinks the legislature really wanted to criminalize, but that because we can imagine that happening, it should justify going out of our way to strike down the whole statute. And I think that's just not how we do that type of review. I do think the legislative history, my friend Mr. Shalom brought up the legislative history. I'm glad he did. I just want to note, I think what one witness says is never going to be dispositive about what the statute means. But when Mr. Finkel testified, actually, he explained why they split out what was then A into A and B to make clear that the prurient requirement was flowing across. And then he said it's because there's a rough proportionality among all of this stuff. And you can go listen to the recording yourselves. I also think if you look at the Senate statement from June 15th, 2017, they say this is just expanding the definition of child pornography. They did label it child erotica. That's not a platonic term of art. They use that word, but they think they're doing something that is allowed. They're trying to do fervor. So to my friend Ms. Gifford's point, they're not trying to invent a new exception. They're trying to fall within the bounds of an existing exception under fervor. We think they did that, and we certainly think you can read it to make clear that they did that, to make sure that no one is worried that a child is ever going to be prosecuted for just posting a picture on Instagram of her, you know, her and her friends at the beach. And of course, if that case ever were to come up, it would be the most obvious case for an as-applied challenge, but I just don't think it's even covered by the statute fairly read. Just at the last, you know, last thing I'll say, there was some question about whether we really need the statute. Maybe everything else, something else can cover it. I'm not sure that, it may be possible that some of our hypos could be covered under other things. The legislature can choose to cover it under this to create higher penalties when a child is involved as opposed to an adult. It would have also been prescribable for Mr. Higginbotham to say these things about a 19-year-old, but the legislature could believe it's worse to say it about a 5-year-old. That doesn't just match our moral instinct, it matches our doctrine. And so I do think...
On that note, do you agree with your colleague that this particular case would have been fully covered under an obscenity statute?
I believe that Mr. Higginbotham didn't have a First Amendment right to. He could have also been prosecuted under the obscenity statute because he did something that, as he concedes, was obscene, and he didn't have a right under the First Amendment to do it. So he has no as-applied defense here because to the extent this statute covers his speech. And again, there's a narrow remedy here, which is just to say, look, he's outside the statute. The statute lives on. That's a far more tailored, modest remedy than what the appellate division did. But he doesn't. What I think is especially important is making clear he doesn't have a right to say these things. And one of the reasons you know that is it's already prescribed as obscenity, but the legislature also could have said, we think it's even worse when a kid is involved. And of course, the most important thing is that the statute survives regardless of what happens to one highly unusual set of facts. I think you've heard from everybody. Nobody knows of a case quite like this. If the court has no further questions, we would ask you to reverse the decision below. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Zuckerman. Thank you all counsel for the very fine argument.